Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Peach State Pandemonium, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network, where we take you down memory lane for a look at professional wrestling the way it used to be, with conversations from those who paved the way. And now, the GWH Radio Network presents Peach State Pandemonium.
Good evening and welcome to Peach State Pandemonium for Thursday, August 14th, 2014. We have here with us Michael Norris, myself, Bobby Simmons, Jerry Oates, and Jay West. How are you guys doing this evening?
I'm doing good, guys.
Me too. Glad to be here.
Yeah, me three. Yeah, it's a good day. We're all here and great day.
I can't believe it's already the middle of August.
Yeah, it's about time for school to start here. For some folks, already has started again.
Yeah, my daughter's school started Monday.
One of the things that I don't miss about no longer working, being retired, is having to get behind school buses in the morning when I would be driving to work. That was always good for my vocabulary.
don't worry about it, brother. I'm hanging right in there for you.
Well, Jay, you want to go ahead and get our sponsor out of the way real quick, and then we'll jump right into the show.
I certainly will. You know, Andy Warhol many, many years ago said everybody gets 15 minutes of fame. Well, with this, I get 15 seconds, so here we go. Tonight's sponsor is Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio entertainment and information. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. Get a free book when you sign up for a 30-day free trial at audibletrial.com/GWHradio. Back to you, Mike.
Well, thank you very much. You just get better each week at that. You guys are going to forgive my voice. I've been yelling at telemarketers all day today.
Well, we've had
new rule for the show. Every time we mention a certain old man's name, he's going to have to pay me $5.
Oh, my goodness.
And, we might as well rack up some money. Charlie Smith. There's 15 bucks right there.
There you go.
He says it's never a good show unless we talk about him. So.
Oh, we can talk about him.
Oh, yeah.
You don't have to worry about saying anything to hurt his feelings because he won't hear it anyway.
Well, I was going through some old programs and saw the infamous program with his picture on the back. So I just want to let him know that his fame exists.
Was it a wood carving? Cause
believe it or not, was that a Gunkel Enterprises program?
Oh, yes.
Do you know that was the only program out of the two-year run, that was the only program that completely sold out?
Well, how many does Charlie have in his basement?
He probably bought 300 or 400 of them. But speaking of Gunkel and Charlie and referees, let me get this out of the way before we forget. I know Jerry, you probably remember him, and I'm sure Jay does. Bill McMahon.
Oh yes.
Bill has been moved into hospice care, and
I'm sure to hear that.
He's not doing great, but I talked to his wife about 30 minutes before our show tonight, and he's holding his own. He's in a coma, I guess you call it. He opens his eyes periodically, but there's no response. He's on oxygen and on painkillers. They say he's in no pain, but y'all please remember Bill and his family. It's a tough time for him. Charlie called me and was telling me today. Charlie ran up there today and saw him, and he said he's not looking good, but. I don't know about you guys. I just kind of, we've known each other forever, and you don't think about it in terms of years, but I was sitting there today at work thinking about it. I've known Bill McMahon for over 40 years.
Right. He came to a lot of your get-togethers on Saturdays. And
yes, he did.
Actually, when Rich was doing the show back while Mike was off, he called in several months ago. So
yes, he did.
Hasn't been that long since we've talked with him.
Yeah, he's... cancer's took his toll on him, and he's a good fella, but just think good thoughts his way. We'd appreciate it.
Absolutely. Very sorry to hear that.
And kind of in a similar vein, We talked about Ken Lucas last week. I guess it was Friday or Saturday, I got a call from my friend Elliot Wiggins, who lives in Pensacola, and he had talked to somebody who was close to Ken or a family member or something, and they did not do any kind of ceremony for Ken except for just his immediate family. They had him cremated, and they scattered his ashes along his beloved Pensacola beach. I can't think of a more fitting place for him to rest eternally than Pensacola. He absolutely loved it. He and Eddie Sullivan, who were, as far as the public knew, were bitter enemies and had some torrid matches against each other all over the Gulf Coast and Tennessee and everywhere, but they were, in true life, the closest of friends. They broke in the business around the same time in Arizona. They were both from the Phoenix area, had known each other forever, and they bought the property that Ken was living on, still living on, and I guess you'd consider it either, I don't know if it was Gulf Breeze or Navarre, but right along there, along not far from the beach, they had bought that property together back in 70 or 71. And Bob Kelly used to tell me that they'd get, Lee would get calls at the wrestling office from the police, Pensacola police, and they'd say, you need to come down here and separate your wrestlers. They're down here hanging out together on the beach, and they're going to blow the whole thing. But that's the way Ken and Eddie were. They owned that property together, and they just, both of them loved Pensacola. And after Eddie died, his widow Barbara, she and Ken was finally going to sell the property and move back to Phoenix, and she and Ken were going to get married, and then she passed away. So he lost a lot of people close to him, you know, in a short span of time, and but hopefully now he's with them, and
right,
he and Eddie and Joe Turner and Dennis Hall are up there pulling ribs, probably stealing angel halos and nailing them to the roof somewhere, locking them up with padlocks or something crazy, I'm sure. But I just wanted to pass that along. For several people have asked me if I knew anything as far as what they did for him, as far as the funeral or whatever. So I thought I'd pass that along. So
thanks, Mike.
You are quite welcome. Well,
one other thing. Let me throw a book review in right quick. I finished the Don Fargo book this week. It's well worth the read. When you finish reading it, you don't know where to think, what a great guy, or how crazy can one human being be. Man, he tells a lot of stuff, and he remembered a lot of things through the help of J. Michael Kenyon and Scott Teal, and just, I mean, it's well worth the read. I'm not getting a kickback on the selling of the books, but it's a good book, and I'm glad somebody got that stuff down on paper before we lose Nye. I mean, we may never lose him. He's pickled. He's not preserved, but I'm glad somebody got some of this stuff down on paper. It's a good read, and it's a quick read. It doesn't take long to read it, and it's only about 300 pages, but they're easy pages to read, and it's a very good book. So,
some great photos in it too. Some I'd never seen before, and it's, having 60,000 photos like I do, to come across, you know, a dozen or so that I've never even seen before is pretty amazing.
A lot of these photos, are they wrestling photos, Mike?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't want to see ones with toothbrushes and cigars. I'm glad he didn't put any of those in there.
Oh, geez.
But, you know, this is another good thing about this show, that there's not a lot of opportunities or areas for fans now to find out about things like this, unless it's got WWE's name on it. You know, there's just not a lot of publicity, so this is just one thing that this program can do, is to let the fans of our era know about books and publications and things of that nature that are out there and available for them to peruse and remember the old days.
Well, I know Scott's got several more in the pipeline that he's working on, and he's trying to convince somebody who was a guest on our show a couple years ago, who probably not a whole lot of people, unless you live up around Detroit, Ohio, that area, even know who he is. Probably some people in Tennessee spent some time there. But a gentleman by the name of Jim Painter, who works as Big Jim Lancaster, just from having him on our show, the guy's got his career so detailed. He's the only person other than Ted Allen that I knew that can tell you where he was, on what date, what the result of his match was, how much he got paid. I mean, Jim kept, you know, I don't want to say diaries, but you know what I'm talking about, logs of everywhere he ever worked and everything, and told some great stories. He spent, you know, time here in Georgia, and just briefly, and got kind of put with Pac Song while he was here to kind of help Pac Song get around and get places and everything. He told a great story about that. So I'm hoping, you know, Scott will convince Jim to do it, because, you know, Jim was never a big star, never main event anywhere. You know, he was just one of those opening mid-card guys, but had a long, long career and helped train some people. And but, you know, those, to me, and has been the case with all of Scott's stuff that he's been doing since the early days of Whatever Happened To, those type guys have more interesting stories to me than the, you know, the big, you know, well-known people, because they're not still trying to promote their own image, you know.
Well, those guys
they were in it for a living and everything else. And Jim's got some great stories, and I'm hoping that Scott will convince him to do a book.
Those guys were important because to them the business was more important than their own ego, you know. And,
exactly. So now if we can just get Jerry Oast to do one.
I'm listening.
You'll have a whole chapter on McGuire twins and one on punch-drunk boxers selling T-shirts for him in Kansas City.
Jeez.
You know, I would imagine Jerry's got some pretty good stories about what he's doing right now. Just, you know, in the early morning hours, who knows what's going on down there.
Since I've been staying with Bobby, I've kind of gotten into a routine, as you do, you know, when you're convalescing the way I am. And I even though I own the whole series on DVD, I never miss Miami Vice in the morning, and I think of Jerry every time I see those guys running down the beach. We're going to get Jerry a white linen suit and a sleeveless T-shirt up under the turquoise.
Well, I mean, I've heard the story of the guy putting the dead alligator over in Mobile. You know, I've heard that story, but, you know, I would think it'd be worth a chapter to talk about Jerry wrestling that alligator on the beach that morning. That'd be good.
That should be on video.
Yeah.
I'm sure you weren't, it wasn't hard to convince you to put him over either, was it, Jerry?
No, it wasn't, no.
Oh, man. Well, what I wanted to talk about this week, and I'll have to rely on the three of you because you have much more experience in this end of the business than I ever would have, and that's television production and how it was done in various ways and how, especially here in Georgia, how they did, you know, bicycled the tape around. And I've heard that expression my whole life, but I never was sure what it exactly meant other than taking it from one town to another. And just, you know, let's see, back in when you started, Bobby, they were doing what, Atlanta TV, Columbus, of course, live, and Macon TV, is that what it was?
Well, when I started actually in the business, but when I first started, they were doing live Atlanta wrestling at Channel 17. That was my whole world. I didn't, or at Channel 11. I didn't know anything else existed. I mean, it was like my world was Atlanta, because you got to remember, I was just starting, and I would help put the ring up and take it down at the TV station, and that was it. And when we first started at Channel 17, before it became a superstation, I knew about Macon TV. I'd never been to it. I'd never been to Columbus TV. I knew about them, but I'd never been to them. But the TV show in Atlanta, it went through a metamorphosis from the time it started until the time that superstation thing hit. It became a whole different animal. We were looked at by the FCC as a network show. We were treated like a network show. We weren't treated like a local wrestling production. No disrespect intended, but the Macon TV or the Columbus TV, they had a lot more leeway to do things than we did, because the FCC just says, well, you can't. Anything, they told us to the second how much commercial time we had. And they put a stopwatch on us. And if we went over, then they weren't fining us. They were fining TBS. So naturally, TBS came down on us pretty hard.
Well, this is what the FCC called the program length commercial rule.
Yeah,
and
it was.
And what it stated was that there had to be a complete separation between the commercial element of the program and the program element.
Right.
And most wrestling shows for many, many years throughout various markets, there was no distinction. The guy would talk about where he was going to be on such and such night, and it would just, you know, it would go strictly from there to the next guy talking about such and such night. And when somebody complained that the show on Channel 17 was a program-length commercial, then things got done quite a bit differently. The guys would talk about, and Gordon was so great at this. I mean, you know, his timing was impeccable. And he would, the guys would come out, and they were going to do this and that to whoever their opponent was going to be. And then all of a sudden, he'd get the cue that they were going to commercial, and you'd see the information go across the bottom of the screen of a particular date. And then at that moment, they would switch from just talking about who they were going to do whatever to everybody to a specific match on a specific night. And then that became the commercial element. All that stuff is gone now, because if you think about it, all these infomercials that run continuously on television, specifically during the night and on your UHF stations, are all program length commercials. That's all they are. But during that time, that's why that regulation, when it was hot, the major market wrestling stations had to be very, very careful about that. And Channel 17, as Bobby mentioned, with the superstation as it was a station that was really looked at close. And actually, it was just somebody that didn't like wrestling, and they got mad one day, and they talked to the FCC, and that's where it came from, as far as what Freddie and I talked about on several occasions, Freddie Miller, the eyeball was put on Georgia Championship Wrestling very, very, very closely over that regulation, and that's where it came from. Sorry, Bobby, didn't mean to jump in on you like that.
That's okay. No, that's good. I mean, that's exactly. I mean, if you will think back, for those of you that can remember the show, and I'll tell you, one of the best at doing this was Wrestling Too. He just had a knack for this. He would get on TV and he would talk about, I'm going to be touring around the state this week. I'll be
yes.
in Macon. I'll be in Columbus. I'll be in Carrollton. I'll be in Columbus, Ohio, blah, 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 blah. Very generically. As long as you did not name a date or a venue,
yes.
you were talking generically. And then all of a sudden, when we – and again, you had to remember, we knew exactly to the second how much commercial time we had.
Yep.
And most of the time within our show, it ran anywhere from 8 to 12 minutes. About 8 minutes was all we normally got, but if TBS did not sell all the time, then they would give us that commercial time. And he'd be just talking generically, and then all of a sudden we'd give him the signal that he had 10, 15 seconds. And, of course, he knew how much time he had to break, but, like, if he was going to be in Carrollton on Saturday night, he would go, Carrollton, 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 tonight. You know, I'm going to get you tonight, blah, blah, blah. So it was that element of our show was unique in that we had to be very, very careful.
Yeah, and the information would run under, you know, at the bottom of the screen.
Right.
And when it went away, that's when that time was up. But you had mentioned the term bicycling tapes, Mike, and it wasn't specific to just, wrestling shows. In what was called the old syndication days, and you had major, medium, and small market stations, whether it was Mr. Ed or what kind of show it was, if it wasn't on the network, then they'd make so many copies of a program, and it would go initially to the major market stations, and then the station would box that program up, and they'd send it to, in this case, say, going from Atlanta to Macon, and then they'd see that syndicated show the following week, and on down the line until it got to the very, you know, very smallest outlets, and then they'd turn the tape back into the syndicators. They'd, in many cases, they'd erase them and start all over again. That's why a lot of those shows that were done in the 50s and 60s, so few of those programs existed until DVDs came out, because they would erase, you know, erase the tape and put the next week's program on it.
Right. I know that's how they did TV in Mobile, at least in the 70s, when they were no longer doing it live. And when they reopened Mississippi, they actually had Mississippi television for each city in Mississippi. Well, that was five different cities that you had to do, you know, try and do live or, you know, tape television shows to play in that market. Well, what they finally did around 71 or so, 71, 72, they just did the TV taping in Biloxi, and then they carried that tape around. Now, in saying that, did somebody actually physically take the tape somewhere, or did you trust mailing it?
Greyhound,
okay.
Greyhound and UPS. We would do the show on Saturday. Now here again, we had a unique situation in Atlanta, because when we did our show on Saturday night, everybody in all the markets was seeing the show anyway.
Yeah.
Right.
So what you would do is you would take that show, and then the next week we would go to the TV station on Tuesday mornings. And backing up a little bit, a lot of the things that people didn't I mean, you know, you just assume things to happen, but we would have to we would have production meetings on Friday afternoon when we actually knew what talent was going to be there, who was going to be wrestling who. Then you had to actually lay the interviews in and for the Saturday show. All of this was done on Friday afternoons. And then on Saturday mornings, Mike, of course, you've been to the TV, you worked there. Mm-hmm. You know, they would have the meeting back in the conference room there before the show went on. And of course, it would be the booker and the assistant booker and Gordon and whoever else might be there that might have, you know, be helping with the production end of it. They would go over who would be where, make sure you got the interviews lined up so somebody knows where they need to be. And you lay your show out. Well, then once that's over, once the show is in the can, so to speak, and it's going to air Saturday night in Atlanta, that's all you can do to that show. It's over. Once the tape started rolling, it never stopped. You know, there was never a cut that wasn't good enough, let's redo that. There wasn't any of that. When that tape started rolling for 58 minutes and 20 seconds, it run, and then 58 minutes and 20 seconds later, you had a show in the can. Whether it was good, bad, or indifferent, it was done.
The only time I ever remembered it stopping was when it was a production problem on the TV, on the station.
That's exactly right. If there was a mechanical issue, we never stopped it. We were selling our business as real. We were selling it as a sport, as professional wrestling. And if you stopped it or did any kind of edit, it opened the door for people saying, "Wait a minute, now I seen that little glitch there. They did something." But once that's in the can, it's in the can. Well, what you didn't know was you already had people like Ole or whoever the booker was at the time. You had Freddie Miller, who was doing the interviews at the time, and after Freddie left, you had Bobby Simmons doing it. We were already looking at those formats for those shows, because we had on Tuesday morning, we had to go back to the TV station with the talent to do interviews for Augusta, Savannah, and wherever else that tape was going to go. And you had to go through, you had to time the show so that you knew exactly the amount of time that interview was. Sometimes 2 minutes and 8 seconds, sometimes 2 minutes, 2 seconds, sometimes a minute 57, it varied. But you had to fill that amount of time, exactly that amount of time, with an interview for the other town. You had to figure out how much commercial time you had in the other town. You had to, there was a lot of pre-production before you ever got to the point where you were doing the interviews. And then you would go in on Saturday morning, or Tuesday morning, and you would cut interviews for that town. And then once the interviews were cut, then the production people there at 17 would insert those interviews into the tape so that, and of course, when we first started, we were talking those 18-pound, 2-inch tapes, and they would get that done. And once everything was in place, and then you left the TV station and you went to the bus station and you sent them to the towns. And the only time you had a snafu with that was if you had a bus accident or they lost a tape, or that would happen sometimes. But if that was the case, then that was when Bobby climbed in the car or the ring truck or whatever and took a tape to wherever. But it was a pretty good process. It seemed to work. Most of the time we shipped everything Greyhound, and they sent it back to us UPS.
Speaking of
now,
snafu.
Did all that change as far as the bicycling the tapes and after it went over the cable?
No, we still did it. We still sent tapes. Yeah, we still see the even though the people would see the show, we still had, there was still a certain amount of people back.
Yeah, I guess so.
That didn't have cable, and they would see the show on a local channel, and it was channel. It was channel 12, I think, in Augusta. We had a channel in Chattanooga. We had one in Savannah. I think that's it. We may have sent a tape somewhere else. I mean, after we started going national, we started running the tours. We had station. We had Cincinnati. We had Dayton, Ohio. We had stations all over. But there were Mr. Ward did his show in Columbus, and his tape, of course, went. They sent a tape to Albany. I guess they used the Columbus show. They might have used the Macon show. I'm not sure which one they used. But then we did the live TV there for a while in Macon. And then when Macon quit doing live TV, Mr. Ward, of course, would send his show to Macon as well. But to get a finished product, it was not as easy as it looked like. I mean, there was a lot of work went into it. And Barnett used to fuss all the time. He used to fuss because Ole would unplug his phone at home. And he would work on booking the TV and working on his bookings and so forth. Then he would plug the phone up and he'd call the office on Friday afternoon and give us the rundown so we could get everything typed up. And Jim used to just raise Cain because he'd unplug that phone. And I remember his favorite line. He said, Bob Hope rehearses for a month to do a one-hour special. And he said, you expect everybody here to do a TV show in 25 minutes. So, you know, but we pulled it off for a long time doing it that way. And it... I'm not saying it was the right way, but it
was the right way, because if you look at and Jerry, you worked in other territories how they did their TV, and of course, other than coming over here to do the TBS show and working for Ron and Ron Fuller and Dothan, that was the only times I was ever on a television program. But it used to kill me how the television was done in Dothan. And Bobby, you've been in the Dothan in the WTVY studio. Jerry, you have too, so you know what size that studio is. It's a very tiny studio, and you're filling half of it up with a ring, and then you've got bleachers on two sides or three sides to house the fans that came to see the show taped on Saturday mornings, and then you've got the set where the desk was, where at the beginning it was Gordon Soley, and then Les Thatcher did it for a while, and Dick Steinborn did it for a while, and then but mainly it was Charlie Platt. But it used to kill me because we would get down there early, an hour or so before they let anybody in to, come watch the matches so they could do the interviews. And it's funny how Fuller used to do it. If he was running five match card in whatever town, four of those matches would have some sort of angle tied to them, whether there was a title on the line or some sort of other stipulation. But how he cut his interviews, he'd have whoever was involved in those four matches interviewed at the desk with Charlie Platt, and the other four, bunch of people that were involved in those matches in the quote-unquote other studio. Well, the other studio was about 15 feet away in the corner of the studio with a backdrop in front of it.
You know, and most
the funniest
fans
thing that used to kill me was if somebody they say we're going to switch it over to the other
right.
studio and you know it'd be Ron Bass and Mr. Saito and Dennis Condrey and Randy Rose, they were all talking about what their matches, you know, and they had one microphone between them and they'd hand the mic off. And Bass would say, I'm going to get Ken Lucas, and he'd hand the mic to Mr. Saito, and I'm going to get Bob Armstrong, and then they'd hand the mic to Randy Rose and Dennis Condrey, and they're going to get whoever they're wrestling against. And then they before, you know, after they thought they were done, they'd switch back to the camera back onto whoever was sitting at the desk. But sometimes the heels weren't finished talking, and you could hear them talking over the
little bleed.
Of course, they'd kill their mic, but you could still hear them talking because they were only 10, 15 feet away.
Right.
Of course, they did all that before anybody, you know, before they let the fans in the building. But you could always tell on a Fuller show if they were going to do something, you know, hot shot something because they, or have something happen, you know, on the set because they do a live interview or not live, a tape, but in front of the audience. That always meant somebody was going to come out and interrupt, and they'd have whatever going on to hotshot an angle.
Well, those
and
studios,
when they would show film of something that happened in a match, they were very careful and never said what town it was in. They'd say this happened in the arenas. That was Charlie Platt's famous thing. This happened, you know, Brad Armstrong was injured, and this is how it happened in the arenas. Because you couldn't tell somebody, okay, this is in Dothan, because they saw the very same thing in Mobile. Same angle, same everything. And people that didn't know what the buildings looked like, they just assumed it was being filmed where they saw it. You know, it could be Montgomery, it could be Birmingham. Because of the way they shot it, you really couldn't see any much more than the ring. So you really couldn't tell where it was actually filmed from. Unless you paid close enough attention to what the guy was wearing that night as far as color trunks or whatever, you really couldn't tell. Most people didn't pay that much attention to it. So,
yeah, the background was pretty dark. You just
yeah.
see pretty much what was in the ring. But those
you could always
studios,
tell Dothan, though, because that red dirt floor.
Yeah, those studios were very deceptive. A lot of people that watch TV, you know, if the studio was built in the 50s or even in the 60s, you thought you were looking at a big studio. But it, as
yeah.
you said, it was very, very small. And in those days, they would take the set, move it over in the corner, and the kid show set would be moved in its place. You know, it was
right.
And it was very, very small. And like you said, yeah, the guy you'd throw it off to the guy in the next studio or whatever who was 10 feet away from you. They still do that a little bit with news. They'll say, now here's whoever from the newsroom, and the newsroom is 10 feet from where they're standing. But it's a little harder now because there's so much electronics involved in the setups for the you know the news desks and all that stuff. But in you know just a few years ago, it was just a desk and a microphone. Now it's a lot more intricate than that. But it you know it's just part of showbiz if you think about it. You know, it's all deception, and they were able to pull that over on the fans. If you look at some of the websites now of some of the old TV shows, Bill Cardeal out of Pittsburgh's got a good one. You can see what, you know, some of those studios really, really look like. That's one from Pittsburgh, but, I mean, it's just him sitting there at ringside with a little bitty monitor and a microphone in his hand, and it's very archaic, you know, and fans had no idea that's what he was looking at when he was calling the match. Jerry, I was wondering, did you ever get schooled on the program link thing where you had to talk about everybody you were going to be going up against and all of a sudden have to go to the specific match? Jerry there.
Did we lose Jerry? Yeah, we lost him. Hang on a minute. He called back in. Let me get him back on.
You got
him? You hear us now, Jerry? Yeah,
yep.
I got you.
Yeah, my phone went off or something. I called back in.
We were talking about the program.
You have to plug them in every once in a while.
We were talking about the program length commercial and how you'd go from talking about generic matches you might be involved in to a specific match. And I wondered if you ever got schooled a lot on that, how you had to be careful on the timing.
No. Most places where I was, you know, we didn't have to worry about that. Only thing about when I was in Louisiana, we would do a 2 weeks' worth of taping. And when you'd go, we would go the next week to do interviews, you wouldn't even know. I mean, you'd have to know who he was wrestling or what it was about. I mean, it was a 2 week delay there. I mean, it got difficult because sometimes you'd have to, of course, Watts had a sheet that, you know, you'd have to look at to see who he was wrestling and who you wrestled the time before, because we did, you know, two tapes at a time.
Right, so you'd have to be brought up to date on where you were in the program as to, you know, if you were doing a series of matches with a guy, as to just exactly where you were in that be able to put that interview over.
Exactly, and that was the trickiest place, because, you know, we only did taping twice a month, and that was the trickiest place.
Was that done in front of the same audience?
What, the interview?
Taping two
no.
weeks worth of, you'd let one out and let another one in?
No, they stayed.
Okay.
Yeah, I know Bill was very, very meticulous when I was around him when he was doing stuff in the Atlanta office. How was he doing his TV? Was he hard to get along with doing TV, or was he, I know sometimes he would get so wound up in what he was doing, it was just hard to deal with.
You know what? You know, I've heard guys talk about him, and you know, I never one time had any trouble with, you know, I mean, I did what I was supposed to do, you know. You know what a stickler he was.
I never had any trouble with him, but that's what I was wondering. I just kid him. I mean, I knew
over
how
Bobby,
he was a perfectionist.
I have seen him many times go berserk at TV.
Yeah.
But nothing that, you know, I mean, and I can understand that, you know. That was a big territory, and you know, it was thousands of miles every week. And you know, he would fly down in his own plane and get there, and he wanted it a certain way, and that's the way it had to be. There was no ifs and buts about it, you know. I've seen him lose it many Saturday mornings.
That's what he was a perfectionist. He wanted everything exactly. He would see it in his mind, and he would transfer it to paper.
That, yeah.
And once
and
he got it
to
paper, he would
that.
Transfer it to the guys, and he wanted it that way.
And you know, and of course, he wouldn't put guys in a position that couldn't do it. Supposedly,
yeah.
You know, that's what you try not to do. You know.
Yeah.
But really and truly, I enjoyed working for him as much as I did anybody. Because he did everything for me. He said he was going to do before I got there, and he did it. And I enjoyed working for Ole. You know, I just believe in, you know, so many guys took it as a game, and it was a business to me. It was the way I made my living, you know.
Yeah.
And if everybody could have looked at it from their side of the desk or in their shoes, you know, it would have been a different situation, you know. How would you like to fly somewhere? You're going to get on a commercial flight, and the pilot smoked up a drunk. You know, because that's happened. But you know, to me, it was a business, and most guys, you know, it was just a fun time. You know, and
it was a means to an end.
Of course, it was fun to me. I loved what I was doing, and I think most of the guys did, but. There were so many guys that didn't take it serious, you know. But out there, you do what you were asked to do, or you were gone. I mean, that, I know my first night in the territory. I had flown out there 2 weeks prior and did 2 weeks of taping, and he wanted to know if I would come or be there. 2 weeks later, I started. I did TV that Saturday morning. Did two tapings in Shreveport. Went to Pine Bluff, Arkansas that night, and he fired Ken Patera as soon as he walked in. I'm thinking, what have I got myself into? And he missed the Thanksgiving shot, and he fired him. And you can't blame him.
No, because Thanksgiving was one of their big shows.
Oh, sure. In most places it was, you know. And if you're booked and you're not going to be there, or just tell the man, look, I'm going home, I won't be back till after Thanksgiving. But, you know, it's a business. It's a business. Or it was a business. And,
yes.
And I always treated it as such. You know, you know, of course, he there was a guy, he was a screamer and a holler, you know, and I don't blame him because that was his money on the line. And you depended on guys, you give them a booking sheet, and are they going to make these towns or aren't they, you know? And I can understand why they did what they did. I really do.
Well, there's,
you know, everybody's got a different personality and a different way of doing things. But that was his way of doing it. It was his territory, and he was the boss, and that was the way it was.
Well, you figure if he was willing, you know, for a guy coming into the territory and seeing what was going on, if he was willing to fire somebody like Ken Patera, then they knew they had to stay in line at least a little bit, right?
Well, exactly. And that never. I didn't know what was going on because I just got there, you know. But that didn't upset me or bother me because I knew what I was there for, and I needed that job at the time. I had left Georgia, and that was my new job, and I took care of it, and I did the very, very best I could. Whatever he wanted, that's what I did.
Where did you guys tape TV in Shreveport? The Irish McNeil Boys Club?
That's when I was there. They did it at the TV station in Shreveport.
Okay.
And then he did move it. I don't know when. I know I left there and went to Oregon, and then I don't know. Then I went to Charlotte from Oregon. I don't know when, but he moved it to a great place. I mean, that place would be packed for TV.
I think that was the Boys Club. I was just wondering what other use things went on in that building besides the TV tapings.
I really don't know because it wasn't used, but that was one of the greatest ideas that I'd ever seen. We did a situation like that in Oregon. We would do TV at the same place we did the house shows. And TV was like a house show with so many people there. I mean, it was packed, and that was a great concept. And I don't know why a lot of places. Bobby, did they ever do TV at the arena there in Atlanta?
I never did TV. Now we did TV at the sports arena for a while.
That's what
when
I'm
I first
about.
Went to work over there in November of '74, they were taping on Tuesdays at the sports arena. Ralph Freed was bringing the production truck up, and we were taping there. They had an announcer for they had Jim Carlisle and somebody doing one for Columbus and I guess Albany or wherever it went. Then they had another set of announcers that did the show for Savannah and Augusta, and we were taping that show there so that it was something different than what they were seeing on TBS.
How long did that last? It didn't last that long.
I mean, it was a pain because sometimes the production would run over and you wouldn't get out of there till 4:15, sometimes 4:30. And for those of us if you were going to Macon, it wasn't a big deal. But for those of us that had to go to Albany, it was tough.
Yeah.
Well, the sports arena back during then actually booked country music dances. I heard they were more knife fights than anything else.
Right. Every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday night. Yeah,
that's right. And you know, even some of the programs had some pictures of them. So that's what they actually did at the sports arena when wrestling would be at the auditorium. But occasionally, you know, Bobby, and I'm sure you remember that because you did ticket pulling and whatnot. Occasionally, in the golden days, the auditorium would have a standard booking for something would be coming in. Once a year or twice a year, the ice show
or the
Shrine Circus.
Ice in February and the Shrine Circus in April and the high school graduations in May and June.
Right. So then they would have to use the sports arena on Friday night for the wrestling. But as that started drying up, then that became less of an issue. But if you look at the old programs, you can see where they had country music dances there on Friday and Saturday
George Geary and the Sports Arena Playboys.
That's right.
Yeah, see, that was only – see, I grew up, you know, where I grew up at, where my church is now, that's the neighborhood I grew up in, Jay. We used to go over there sometimes on Friday and Saturday night. My mom would kill me if she knew I did this. We used to go over there, and just sit outside and watch them because, oh, yeah, they would throw each other out the windows. It was good.
Yeah, you're taking your life in your hands over there.
Oh, yeah.
Kind of reminded me of during the late 60s when WQXI would have their dances at Misty Waters Country Club out there in Conyers off 20. Yeah, you were taking your life in your hands, but it was where me and the guys had to go if we wanted to learn from the more successful bands that were working, you know, being booked by the WQXI, and that's what you watch. But yeah, they were more knife fights, I think, in some cases than they were actual dances.
Now, the sports room, that's where the office was, wasn't it?
Where the office was, yeah.
And didn't Paul Jones own that building?
Paul Jones owned the building, yes, he did. It would seat about 3,000 people. It was an old Warren Arena. It was originally built back in the 40s or 30s or 40s by L.G. Warren, who owned a big refrigeration company, and he had a professional women's basketball team. And he built that arena for them to play in. And the sports arena in Atlanta, it had a storied past. The first time Elvis Presley ever performed in Atlanta, he performed at the sports arena. The first time Kenny Rogers performed in Atlanta, he performed at the sports arena. And there was a ton of people went through there over the years. They played basketball there. They had wrestling matches there. It was a multi-use facility. No, it's not there anymore. No, it's gone.
It's not there.
But it was a neat facility. We even looked at it when the auditorium, when they told us the auditorium was shutting down. You know, the Barnett knew, and that you could not run the Omni every Friday night like we were running the auditorium. And the city auditorium in Atlanta was a great if they sold out Atlanta on Friday night, it covered the overhead for the office and the TV production for the week, and whatever else was made the rest of the week other than paying talent was money that the office made. And when that was good, we knew that was going away. Jim actually had me do some research about opening the arena up again. But it had gone, the laws had changed so much, the ramps inside of it were way out of proportion to what the handicap laws said they had to be or could be. It would have been too economically unfeasible to try to run it again. But we looked into running it again.
It wasn't a lot of
hard. Who owned it at the time?
Paul Jones?
Yes. There wasn't a lot of parking there, and it had become a pretty rough section, right, Bobby?
Yeah. It had gotten better, but as far as the neighborhood was concerned. But it was just, the parking, there was the big, huge, see, Paul owned that land all the way back to the expressway. So all of that big lot behind it was his. You could have, you know, of course, the deal would have said plenty of free parking, but you could have parked cars there, but it was on a bus line where people that rode the bus could have got there. You could have put 3,000 people a week in it, but it just from a financial standpoint, it was going to cost way too much to get it, to get all the licenses and the permits approved so that we could run there.
Well, next time I go to church with you, Bobby, when we come back that way, you're going to have to show me the street where Holy Chase Zulu down the road.
Oh, I'll be glad to. It's right there. That's not a problem.
Well, Jerry, you worked in Dallas briefly, didn't you?
Yes.
Did you work at the Sportatorium?
Yes, I did.
Now, you talk about a storied building. It's been torn down, but when Fritz, did he always do his TV taping there, or did he wait until World Class came along? I know he did live shows there.
We did the TV in Fort Worth.
Okay.
On Monday nights.
Because the World Class Wrestling, when it got to be so big in the 80s, I know it was filmed at the Sportatorium there. And that building looks so wonderful on television, but from what I understand, it was a rat's nest.
It was a dump.
Once again, the glories of TV and what they can make you think you're seeing.
Yep. They just never could make me look good on TV. Well, you talking about Portland, Jerry? You talking about the building where you guys tape TV in the house? That's the one with the crow's nest, right? Did we lose Jerry again? Yeah,
no,
with Frank Bonamera, wasn't that the announcer? He and Don Owen used to do the commentary up in like up on a mezzanine that overlooked the ring.
Yeah, it was up a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah, they called it the crow's nest.
Because
guys they'd have to climb up the stairs to go do an interview.
But it was
wasn't ugly before, but I'm thinking
it was
more pretty.
I mean, it was just unbelievable for TV. I mean, because it was like a house show.
Yeah, they packed some people in there. I mean, they were right up on the ring from the tapes I've seen of it. And
yeah, that's the only place with that territory we did TV. So I guess that TV they bicycle it around.
You know, when I was doing the ring announcing when I first started in July of 1974 in the old Turner studio there on Spring Street, I did it for 4 or 5 months, and then Les Thatcher came in and they changed the format a little bit. But then I came back in 1978 and started working TV again, and really there was legitimately no difference in that studio in that four-year time. But Bobby, can you talk about the differences production-wise when they went from the old Turner Studios over across 75 to the new Turner building?
Well, the one thing you got, well, the first of all, the original studio, it was originally Channel 5, the CBS affiliate here in Atlanta. When they moved out and built their big new facility out on Briarcliff, that became available, and that's when Turner moved in because it was already wired and so on and so forth. The studio would only seat about 90 people after you got the ring in there. It was very small. It was tiny. You were very limited in what you could and could not do. The equipment was, it was good. It was broadcast quality, but it was very old. The thing that made that little station so unique and so great was the talent that was there running it. R.T. Williams was our original director. Pooch Johnson, who was an engineer who later on had his own company and production company in Atlanta, was one of the engineers. I cannot call the guy's last name. His name was Joel. He was the audio guy.
Goddard?
He was like, pardon me?
Was it Goddard?
Maybe. I don't know. He was like an icon in the audio industry of TV, and he was working there because he had had some alcohol issues, and he was trying to work his way back up the ladder. But he was just,
I think that's who it was.
And just, I mean, it was just if you remember, Jay, even the lighting panel where you plug the overhead lights up. I mean, it looked like an old operator switchboards out of the movies where you had wires running everywhere. Plugging them in. It was just
think about like you said when that was built, you know, and it was
And you think about the neat thing about this studio, above the everything in the studio is painted black behind the seats and up against the, so it looks like infinity from the camera view. But above the lights, above the grid of lights, was a catwalk that went all the way around the studio. Many Saturdays I've saw an inebriated Ted Turner standing up on that catwalk watching the matches. You couldn't see him unless you just knew he was up there. I don't know. It was a great atmosphere for wrestling, and it was new. Everything was new from the aspect of it was something totally new for Georgia, for Atlanta wrestling, because Turner wanted us there. Where Channel 11 had jacked them around on their time and didn't care if they were there or not, this guy actually wanted us there. and we turned out to be the hottest thing he had. But when we moved over to the other place, he bought on the other side of the interstate, he bought the old Commerce Club. It was a men's club. It was an old mansion. And the studio, immediately when you walked into the studio over there when they got it set up, it was about 7 or 8 times as large as what we had originally had. You could put the ring in the middle of the studio. They were doing Southeastern Conference football pregame, postgame, scoreboard shows. All of that was on the other end of the studio. It never come into play with what we did. You could put anywhere from 100 to 150 people in the studio to watch the matches. The only thing that didn't really change, we dressed in the old building, we dressed in the lobby. They put boards up in front of the windows, and we dressed in the lobby of the station. And at the new place, we dressed in the cubicles in the offices of the people that worked there. And I'm sure they were thrilled on Monday morning when they come in, because they never knew what they was going to find in there. it was interesting, to say the least. But yeah, the production, the facility itself was like going from the outhouse to the penthouse.
Yep.
Much better equipment, much better lighting, much better. Everything over there was better because he was the superstation then. He was developing that image. He's thinking, this is before CNN, but he's thinking CNN. He had all these ideas, Cartoon Network, all these things running through his head. And that place has grown so much, when you ride up the interstate now and you look in there, unless you know what you're looking at, you don't even know what the original studio was, because the buildings are all, I mean, he's got 10, 12, 15, 20-story buildings built all around that campus, and the original studio still sits right in the middle of that old Commerce Club.
I know one thing. That was the coldest building, especially in that studio. That was the coldest I think I've ever been in my life, was sitting in there.
But, you know, we sit here and talk about how antiquated all that was. I mean, I'm talking about the original TBS, the little TV station we went to in Macon, the arena there in Columbus.
Yep.
And look at what a product was turned out of all of those little stations, those little the arena in Columbus, and the money that was drawn week in and week out of those type productions. I mean, that speaks volumes for the people that were doing it. I mean,
saying the arena in Columbus. You're talking about where Fred did his show from?
Yeah, the old sports arena, yeah.
Well, that building was as big as Expo Hall in Mobile, where they ran their house shows. I mean, that was a nice building where Fred's show was.
And
that studio he's talking about in Macon. Jerry, you remember we had to dress in the film storage room or the video storage room or something. You didn't, most of the time you didn't have a chair.
We dressed in closets, Bobby.
It was awful. You had a little sink. I mean, you didn't have a shower. You had a sink. You had to go. At one time, I was having to go to Savannah when I left there. And, man, it was just, oh, God, it was awful.
And look at the money making, Drew, off of that type situation.
Yes, sir.
Well, but look at
those. You were in the professional wrestling business, you know? Yeah, that was your trade-off for
exactly.
That.
And you didn't think anything about it. You just did it.
No.
You know, they had a room for everybody to dress in Dothan, but unless you were, you know, one of the regulars there, you stood out in the hallway after you got dressed, which is what, you know, those of us that went down there just to do jobs on TV, you know, we'd get dressed and then make room for the others to go in there, and so you'd take your bag and go stand in the hallway and stand and watch the matches.
Any of you guys ever go to the Sportatorium in Tampa?
Yeah.
Yes, sir.
You talking about the Eddie Graham Sports Arena?
Well, it was called the Sportatorium then.
106 North Albany Avenue.
North Albany Avenue, yep.
Do you remember how tiny that was?
Yes, sir.
And the money they drew in Florida, well, that's, I mean, it's amazing. And they talk about today,
think
the
about
money
that,
they draw and this and this. Come on.
Can you think of how much they drew every Tuesday night at the Fort Heschley Armory, and what a bad building that was. No air conditioning, no heating. You know, and they would sell standing room only tickets. They'd have them line the walls.
They did not care. they did not care. I'm telling you.
No, they had that mezzanine that went all the way around the building.
Yes, it did.
And where the babyface dressing room was upstairs, but that mezzanine wrapped all the way around the building, and they'd be lined up three people deep on that mezzanine.
And
I'm surprised they never got shut down by the
fire
department. I guess Eddie Graham was political enough; he could.
Well, you know, all of this, Jerry said it, but it all speaks volumes for the knowledge and the expertise that the people that booked these, that were the bookers, or as Renessa used to say, the manipulators of the talent, to put them in a position to pique people's interest that they were willing to go buy tickets. And it didn't matter. I mean, it didn't matter if you were producing this at Paramount Studios or you were doing it at that little hole-in-the-wall studio in Macon, Georgia, on top of that mountain down there. You know, they did enough. I mean, it was just, it wasn't where it was done and not so much as how it was done. It was the product that was put out there, and you know,
it
it's
was
a
what
shame.
Was done. Yes,
it's a shame. Those days are gone, fellas. We ain't ever going to see that no more. And
I was thinking about this today. Now we talked about all this stuff: these little studios, these little buildings, the old equipment in some places, seat 90 people or 50 people or whatever. Now what amazed me, as smart as he was, had to have been a smart man, was Ted Turner. When he finally got in possession of it, he hired idiots to run the wrestling business.
Yep.
He hired people. Who was Jim Herd? What did he ever do? What did he know about the wrestling business?
Well, he run Pizza Hut, or was that the guy that run Pizza
Hut?
Yeah,
Pizza Hut, I think.
What did he do?
Well, I think by the time Turner finally, you know, he hadn't had it very long when Time Warner bought him out, and I think they're the ones that placed most of those people in place.
Well, that's what that makes you wonder about their mentality.
Well, they didn't know. They didn't know what they were doing. They were thinking that it was just another television production, and it's not. Unless you have people that know how to present that, you know.
And what they did, they hired... Y'all know who they were, the wrestlers that won time to run it. And all they did was sit there and milk Ted Turner's pocketbook instead of taking care of what should have been taken care of and run it the way that they should have known how to
they
run
had,
it.
They had guaranteed contracts, so you
well,
know.
They didn't care.
They had a short-term payday that was, you know, definitive, and they knew they had that. And they were just going to milk it for all it was worth, and then they were gone, you know, and they didn't care. It was a cash cow for as long as their contract lasted.
Exactly.
But Ted Turner was, I mean, I never got that. And then when the other group took it over, it was even worse. And those guys were making fortunes.
Mm-hmm.
And it was as bad as what you see today. It was hideous.
But it didn't last, did it, Jerry? I mean, you know,
No, it did not. And I blame all of them for that. I blame all of them. You know, greed. That's you know, it was the now today. But what about next week, next month, next year? You know, they.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I shake my
head. Where
are
those guys at today?
Exactly. And what slays me, you know, is. It was guys that worked as long as I did and you know, over the years, and how you wind up physically.
Oh, yes.
I saw some of those pictures from that Fan Fest thing in Charlotte, and I didn't know who some of the guys were.
I didn't either.
I had to keep looking day after day to see if there was a name by, and you know, of course, that's what we chose to do, you know. I mean, you know, I've had a total of 8 operations from what I did. And still have problems today, you know, like shoulders and neck and all that, but just like the rest of us. But you know, we paid a heavy price for what we did physically, and to see it abused even when Turner first took it over. I mean, it was. And then another thing, getting back, you know, the thing Charlotte had. It was unbelievable. It was the most unbelievable territory I've ever been in. I mean, the money that was drawn there. And they had a hokey TV situation. We went to Raleigh to do the TV. And that was a hokey thing. But how can you knock it for the money that was drawn? It was by what was done there with the people and the minds that put it together. And then when this thing happened with Turner, you know, after his dad died, he started jumping on everybody. The Crockett's tried to run the whole country themselves, like he was doing. And you see where that wound them up. I just don't know. Here was Turner had his own nationwide TV. He couldn't do anything with Vince McMahon. That blows my mind.
Well,
that absolutely blows my mind.
I think in the end run there, the Crockett's during their last hurrah felt like they had to compete with Vince McMahon. And, they said, the heck with the fans and the heck with everything else and what they've been used to over the years. This is what we're going to have to give them in order to compete with Vince. And that wasn't what the fans wanted. And it ended up, showing at the gate. They paid more and more money. They paid more and more money for guys that weren't going to produce for them. And in the long run, the fans saw one time, and they liked okay, but they weren't the guys that could make those long hauls and last for months and months and months, and the fans would come back to see over and over again. They killed their own territory.
They killed their own territory. That's exactly what they did. They tanked like everybody else.
Yep. And McMahon ended up with it for practically nothing.
Yep.
They put themselves out of business.
He did. He put everybody in the country out of business.
Yep.
And once he put everybody out of business, there was more talents in his home than he had.
Yep.
And from what I see, bits and pieces, here and there, he's not doing good at all.
Well, he's finally overexpanded. And the cable situation and if you read the wrestling news, which I do, and primarily just to see the shape of the guys that were, who's left around from the days that I was familiar with, but he's expanded himself to the point that he depends on others to get his product out there, and it's costing him a lot of money. And he's got, he went public, so he's got stockholders, and he's got to answer to them. And it's no longer his company per se, and I think it's going to hurt him. He's going to see the hurt now. He's made some mistakes over the years, but he's always been able to come back from them. But this is going to be very interesting here within the next year or two to see what's going to happen with him.
You're not kidding. And when this really first happened, everybody being put out of business. My thought was, where are you going to get talent? He had enough talent, and a lot of the guys were young enough that lasted for 15 years. Some of them lasted a little longer. And then when they started going, you can have a school, you can train guys for 5 years. But until you actually have experience, road experience, in the ring, every night. You can't get in the ring once a week. I'm talking about every night.
Right.
Bobby knows, and all three of you know what I'm talking about. Every night, working with different guys, learning psychology, learning business. You can't do it in a school. And
nope.
The talent he brings up, the young guys, what does he do now like a WrestleMania? He brings in the older guys.
Yep.
What does that tell you? He has nobody with drawing power anymore.
And he's got about as many people in drug rehab as he does on his actual talent roster right now.
I don't doubt that. And everybody talks about he made it what it is. I mean, for what it is today. But look how many guys have died. A lot of it's their fault. I'm telling you, if Bill Watts had been running that, he wouldn't put up all them drug addicts. He wouldn't have put up with it. I wouldn't have put up with it. It was like they were wild. It was just like a Wild West show. You know, they what they wanted, and you know, I mean, all the crazy stuff he did, the death of Owen Hart falling out of a ceiling on a, you know, I mean, come on, man. You know, that's, you look at the whole picture, and
he became a different kind of drug addict. You know, the personification of the WWE wrestler had to have a certain physique. And, you know, that became the new drug. And those guys, I've seen the synopsis on them. The guys that have come along in the last 20 years, so many of them have died or have terminal-type situations, much more so than the guys from the 60s and 70s who lived a much more difficult lifestyle, because they, you know, they had their own drugs, but it didn't have the same effect on their heart and their liver and everything else that the steroids did on these guys that came along from McMahon.
Well, Jerry, you're talking about, you know, them learning psychology and how to work with different people. That doesn't matter anymore.
No.
They all work one style of match, the WWE style. And Vince has got exactly what he wants. There's not one person that's the star. His brand is the star.
Yep.
You know, whereas, you know, back in the old days, people would turn out to see Jack Briscoe if Jack Briscoe was in town, or Dory Funk Jr., or Harley. You know, it doesn't matter. His titles don't mean anything to them anymore.
Absolutely.
You know, they pass it around. But it's like, you know, the modern fans, for those of you that visit websites that the current fans go to, you know, their mindset is, if you're with the company long enough, it doesn't matter how good a worker you are or how over you are, you get a chance with the world championship. You know, they pass it around like, you know, everybody in the whole company gets at least one turn with it. I mean, you know, this guy, The Miz, he was there, what, 3 weeks? They put the world title on him.
Right.
He fizzled out. They took it off of him. You know, it's just, it's unbelievable. And then people talk about, you know, we don't want to, you know, you can't be successful having a champion be champion 4 years in a row. Well, tell that to Bruno Sammartino and Dory Funk Jr.
Well, he doesn't make his money off of ticket sales. He makes his money off of the product that they sell over the internet and also at the arenas. As Jerry had mentioned that about going to one of the shows and how much of the, you know, how much of the stuff they had for sale on each one of the guys that were there. And McMahon owns their ring name, and he owns their persona. So who gets the money?
Yep.
But
you know, I don't know.
If it's professional football, professional baseball, basketball, hockey, it's all traveling road shows.
Yep.
That's all it is. They all are. Traveling road shows for entertainment. When the Yankees come to a town, just that name, but like Jay was saying, his thing is the product, the name. But when the Yankees come to town, they got your Derek Jeters, they got this one, they got that one. People want to see those people that come with the Yankees. That's my thing. I'm still on the line.
Well, I think something, too, that just...
Was I still on the line?
Yeah,
you're here.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, you know, the thing, you know, somebody mentioned the certain look, the physique. They all look the same. And the thing, and you mentioned working every night. None of them know how to work. None of them. You know, one of the things that in this Fargo book I just read, one of the things he said, they say today that our style back in the day was boring because we worked holes. He said, but we could work a hold and make you believe we were killing each other. He said, because we did it with facial expressions. We did it with psychology. We did it with when to get loose and when to get it back and when to do certain. And he said, nobody today knows how to do it. And that's exactly the thing.
They look like robots. They look like robots.
Yeah.
And there's so much air between them, and they work so loose. You know, how believable is it if when a guy, you know, he's rocking you with forearms and clotheslines, and then he goes to climb up on the top rope, and you stand up and wait on him? and catch him. Hold your arms out and catch him when he jumps off.
But I don't see how they draw any money at pay-per-view because, I mean, who is the man that draws the money? There has to be somebody. When LeBron James goes back to Cleveland, what do you think? It's going to be astronomical.
Yep.
In anything you steal, I guess time may really be passing me by, but I always thought you had to have a star.
Yeah.
No, the star is the whole production. Because people now, when they buy, you know, tickets to go to the pay-per-view, you know, all they're there to do is see if they can get their face and their sign on TV.
You're right.
And then the ones that are watching it at home, all they do is they just get a bunch of people and get drunk and watch it. You know, today's fan has no clue about what is what, you know. They have 42. If you notice, everybody that works for him is not a wrestler. They're a superstar.
Right.
Well, you can't have 50 superstars, you know.
It's a video game mentality, and everybody's interchangeable.
Exactly.
And if you don't have some type of bizarre action every second, then you know, it's not Major League. And it's so interchangeable. Once that guy's gone, you bring the next one in and do the same thing. And you can't have a
exactly.
guy that's going to last for an extended period of time.
Well, you know, Vince is so smart, he don't ever miss anything. I bet you a dollar he's got a tattoo parlor that goes around with him that tattoos all those guys. It's I don't know. I don't know. It's really hard to talk about.
I understand that. Well, hold that thought, everybody. Jay, it's a little bit after the hour, so why don't you go ahead and get our second word from our sponsor in, and then we'll continue on from there.
I'll try. I got to calm down. I'm so worked up over what we've been talking about here that I got to settle myself down a little bit. The Peach State Pandemonium podcast is happy to be sponsored by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken digital audio entertainment and information. They have over 150,000 titles to choose from, and you can listen to them on any device, including whatever you're hearing us on right now. And if you sign up at our URL, which is audibletrial.com/GWHradio, you get one free audiobook and a one-month trial of the service. Back to you, Mike.
Well, getting back to what we were talking about, it I think until TBS went nationwide with their show and everybody got to hear Gordon Solie, what a difference between Gordon Solie in Atlanta and Tampa versus the local weatherman or the local, you know, whatever, radio disc jockey. Now, I grew up in Mobile. I saw Columbus TV whenever, you know, I lived in Columbus, but I really didn't remember because I was real young. But for the most part, I got hooked on wrestling, you know, in Mobile. And our television show, the commentator / ring announcer, we only had one, he did all of it, was a gentleman by the name of Don Griffith, and he was very good. He was the most animated person doing introductions that I ever saw. He always repeated the competitor's last name, which is what the guy that came along that Vince had years ago called Mr. Kennedy. That was all, you know, by repeating his last name all the time. Don Griffith did that. And he would squat down and point at him, and it was just, he was so animated. And he gave everybody a nickname. He was the one that actually coined the name for Dick Dunn as Dynamite Dick Dunn. And it was Battling Bobby Fields and Dangerous Don Carson and, you know, Rugged Rip Tyler and Sensational Eddie. So they all had some sort of nickname. And he was like that. But the only thing about him was, and of course I didn't know any different watching him. He was telling what was going on in the ring. But every slam or every toss was a flying mare. That's just like if you've ever seen Chattanooga TV, not Chattanooga, Knoxville, from before the Fuller days, when it was John Kazana and Big Jim Hess, who I think was a I don't know what he did outside of wrestling. I'm sure he was involved in television or radio or something. But everything was a warp your head off hold. It didn't matter what it was a warp your head off hold. And the thing that was so entertaining about him was he always got into verbal confrontations with Ron Wright, and those two were as good as Abbott and Costello to me. But if you didn't know any better, you know, that's what you were used to, and they still drew off of that, because I think, going back to all we were talking about, production and all that stuff, and the booker putting everything together and the talent that was putting on, I think the key to all of it was the television commentator, whether he knew the holds or not. But if he was your local guy and that's who you watched, and, you know, he was a celebrity. The difference, the culture shock for me, the first time I went to Tampa when I was 12, 13 years old, from listening to Don Griffith do, you know, Gulf Coast Wrestling, to listening to Gordon Solie, who was, you know, sounded like Howard Cosell as far as the intricacies of what this hold was and what the effect of this hold was and how it affected the competitor in the ring and all this. It was amazing.
You know,
Les Thatcher was as good when I would hear him. You know, and everybody that in Memphis loves Lance Russell,
right,
and Dave Brown, and they were very good. But there again, they were more folksy, and they really weren't selling it like, you know, a serious sport, in my opinion. Bob Caudle was a good one in the Charlotte territory. Jim Carlisle was good. I only heard Ray McKay whenever he did, from what I've seen of the All South stuff that I've got on videotape. But he was very good. And they all played it fairly straight. Now, I guess that's the difference in hiring somebody to strictly do that and to put your what you're selling over seriously, as opposed to grabbing the local, you know, disc jockey or weather guy or whoever else you can get to stick in front of a microphone and have him interview the wrestlers.
Well, in the 60s, you know, I've talked about that when I was first time you interviewed me. You had one of two type guys that would end up doing the show. It would either be a guy that worked for the office who wasn't a professional announcer, and that's where a lot of those colloquialisms came from. But the benefit of using them was they already had an office job or something of that nature. Plus, you didn't have to explain the business to them. They already knew it, so it was an inside guy that you didn't have to worry about that. But they weren't a pro. The other more common in the early days was that the station bought the show or you bought time on the station, and they just took one of the booth announcers or one of the regular guys that did the movie and did the kid show or whatever not, and they became the host of the TV wrestling show, and that was the more common, and you had a built-in audience for these guys because the audience were already aware of who they were. Gordon was a little bit different. He had been a stock car announcer. He'd done radio, but, Gordon will admit he had a face for radio, and so he wasn't a guy that had long-term commitment within doing local TV-type programs as his bread and butter. And he studied the business, and that's what he wanted to be, was a wrestling announcer. It wasn't just another job for him. And he came along at the right time there in Florida when the Florida office was just bustling. And they were one of the few southern offices to get a lot of national magazine coverage. And so Gordon became a national star quickly, and everybody, you know, wanted to see or hear or look at Gordon Solie, and he was the guy. And you had your local guys like Lance Russell, who was very good, but he was a local guy doing the news in Memphis. Dave Brown did the weather. Most of these other guys had some type of job that they did with the station. Whereas Gordon was the voice of the NWA in Florida and later on Georgia, and then later on some other places. So,
have you heard the story of how he got that job in Tampa?
No.
He, as you mentioned, he was doing stock car racing, and I don't know if it was he knew Luttrell or Eddie Graham or who it was, but he was fairly close to him, you know, acquaintance of theirs. And the original host of Championship Wrestling from Florida was a kids host named Salty Saul Fleischman. And he was so upset the first time that the Von Brauners, with their Nazi gimmick, and Saul Weingroff did Florida Tampa TV, he was so upset at this Jewish manager managing these Nazis, which obviously tells you he wasn't smart, and him being Jewish, he walked out. And they scrambled, and whoever it was that knew Gordon got him in there, and the rest is history.
That's right. Just worked out.
You're talking about these local guys or whatever. I think it depended on the market as to what you could get away with and what people were used to. Something that we would want, or, you know, you're talking about your guy in Mobile there, he probably wouldn't have worked somewhere else.
No.
What's the guy in Kansas City, Jerry, that does the TV? It's about 100 years old, or did the TV.
Bill Kirsten.
Bill Kirsten,
His catch thing was to holler, "Hello, wrestling fans," but stretch it out over about 35, 40 seconds. And they had him do it at the Cauliflower Alley Club. They honored him out there 2 years ago and had him do it. And I was thinking, geez, you know, I mean, to me it was very cartoonish. But the people in Kansas City and the people that were out there from that Midwest area that had watched him and grew up with him, they thought it was the greatest thing since the Ice Cube.
They didn't know any different, Bobby. That's all they knew.
That's exactly.
Which one of them was it that said, "Watch out for flying chairs"? Was that Frank Bonamere in Portland?
I don't know about
somebody
that
used to say it, or maybe it was the guy that was wasn't Bill Welsh in L.A.
Well, we talked about this before. The guy in Macon, Georgia, his catchphrase was, "Hello, people."
Right.
And we ain't figured that out yet.
Not yet. And then Boyd Pierce out there for Watts.
Yes.
I mean, he was good.
Yeah, but you had to give Boyd, you gave Boyd extra points for the suits he wore.
Yes, I was fixing to say, I used to like to watch his tapes just see what he had on.
That was one funny man, I'm telling you. He was good, though. He was good.
I love
but
Boyd Pierce and Reese
Rebellion. He wouldn't have worked in Atlanta.
No.
And then... The most cartoonish announcers that I ever saw come down the pike was Monsoon and Heenan.
You know, everybody thinks they were so wonderful.
That was the sickest. Heenan, he wanted to be a stand-up comic so bad. You know, him and Monsoon, that's all. They didn't talk about the matches. They did, I don't know what they were talking about. It was
well, I blame all that on Jim Barnett. Because Jim Barnett brought Roddy Piper in, and that was the very first heel announcer. Now everybody thinks there's got to be a heel announcer. You know, it went from Piper to Heenan and Ventura and all that, and it's just, you know, it's ridiculous.
You're
not supposed, the commentator's not supposed to pick sides. Gordon never did. You know, he would show some disgust if a guy got away with something and a referee didn't catch it, but he wasn't, you know, he wasn't
but
making a big deal about it.
And that's just my opinion on Heenan and him. I just couldn't believe it. I just
I felt the same way. I couldn't watch their product. And then when they gave them their own talk show with Lord Alfred Hayes, who was a great heel, and made him out to be some sort of you know, Alfred the Butler from Batman.
Exactly.
They could sell the time, you know. They could make. They made money off of it for a while.
Oh yeah.
And then,
the whole thing. Getting back to McMahon, and I don't want to harp on that, but he never wanted, and still doesn't want to be associated with the wrestling business. He wants to be in the entertainment business.
Well, you know what that was all about. It was to keep him having to pay fees to the commission. And
exactly.
That's where that initially came from. It worked out very, very well for him in the long run, but it killed, you know, it killed that element of the business. But you know, when they were putting the pressure on him to pay commission fees, and he thought he was bigger than God at that, by that point, he wasn't going to do that. So he just, and he knew he was the only act in town. So what was it going to cost him? You know, that's what started that, and. So there you go. That was the final nail, as far as I was concerned, in the business when he said it's all a, you know, it's all a work.
Yep. Huh. Well, Jerry, you traveled around more than the rest of us. What was the absolute worst studio you ever worked in?
The worst studio? Probably Macon. No, really. It was as bad as anything I ever was associated with. We wrestled at a TV station in Shreveport, but it was nothing like, you know, it was probably on the order of, I don't know. I mean, it wasn't bad. It was a TV studio, but it wasn't bad. We had a nice place to dress. In Macon, like Bobby said, you had to dress in, if you could find a closet. There may be a room up in that.
Wasn't
closet.
Occupied.
The first time I went down there, I was in the movie room between two racks. Didn't have no place to sit, and I was trying to tie my boots up, and Choo Choo came in. And when Choo Choo came in, the room was full.
Well, you were done. But to answer your question, Mike, I guess it would be Macon. It was hideous.
Well, all your tours of Japan, do they do a weekly television program in Japan?
Yes.
Or do they just film the house
show? They would do it in a house show. But see, when they would show it, one time it went over the whole country. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So did they do it as compared to how it was done in the U.S.? Did they do promo interviews and all that type stuff? Or do you know, were you ever involved in any of that?
Yeah, but there was really no interviews like that. It was just, you know, I don't know what they did. Well, I mean, while we were there, they didn't do any interviews. I don't know if the Japanese boys did. None of us ever did. But I don't know if they inserted something. Well, hey, I just don't know how they did that.
I'm just wondering how they promoted their house shows, because they always, everything I've ever seen of the DVDs and everything I have of Japanese wrestling, the place is packed. And you talk about
exactly.
Ceremony.
Yeah, take it very seriously, wasn't it, Jerry?
Oh, very. I mean, we'd get in the ring, they present us with flowers and...
And all the streamers,
you know,
and...
It was. You've never seen posters like they put out. I still got some. I got some hanging up in frames in my office. I mean, they put out a first class poster. When you pull into a town, posters would. There's no telling what they spent on posters. Posters everywhere. I mean, everywhere. Big, beautiful, colored posters. And you know, their TVs, sometimes we could catch TV. I know I used to catch Inoki's shows on, you know. Of course, you can't read anything, so you just caught them by luck. You know, you couldn't look at a TV guide over there or nothing. You know what you were looking at. They would just say, doing TV tonight, that's it. There was no big deal. It was just, you go out there and have your regular matches because the place is packed. You know, it being a big deal.
And those Japanese ring announcers were unbelievable.
Unbelievable.
You thought they were having a heart attack every time they introduce a match. I mean.
You know, they were dressed.
I can hear in my head right now how they used to introduce Terry Funk or Terry Funky. Well, let me ask you this, and this has got nothing to do with television, but I know you and Ted won titles over there, and it seems like everything I've ever seen is some sort of title. Everybody gets trophies. Did you have to leave those with the office when you left the country? Or did you
I got my trophy. Ted's got his. I still got mine. Ted's got his.
Well, you guys are all Asian tag team champions or something?
All Asian, yeah. We left the belts, of course. But that was a big, you know, production. But it was, of course, you know, every night after before our match, they would bring the belts to us, and after our match, they would, you know, they took care of them. It wasn't nothing like in this country throwing the belts around, beating the posts with them, and
You know, they put, I mean, they were Japanese, they're immaculate. Everything was professional looking. I mean, they were, you know, they looked like they just come out of the factory. You know, they took care of that stuff. I mean, we didn't wear no ragtag belts, you know. Some of them made in some machine shop somewhere, you know. and put on a weightlifting belt. It wasn't none of that stuff. I mean, it's first class. Everything over there. I love going over there because it's such class. It was class, you know. You were treated with respect. And
so you got more than $15 payoff, huh?
Yes, sir.
I mean, yeah, I know, just looking at that, and I think that's, you know, that preceded all the production values and everything that came to the States in the 80s. They were big-time productions back in the 50s and 60s. I mean, I've seen videos of Ricky Dozen and just, you know, of course, I have no idea what their ticket prices were over there,
right.
But I've never seen a Japanese match that wasn't absolutely packed, except for, you know, the light bulb and barbed wire and chainsaw matches that they have now over there. But,
I mean, you know, every time I went, you know, you just couldn't believe the people they drew. You couldn't believe it. You couldn't believe it. And you'd get off the bus and you're like a movie star. They're taking pictures of you. I know when we flew in, when Ted and I went together, when they met us at the airport, they met, you know, all of us. I think every one of us showed up at the same time. Sometimes we want to show up a day or two earlier, one later. But the ones that were there, after we went through customs and got our bags, The newspaper was there. The magazines were there, taking pictures of us coming out of the airport, getting on the bus. I mean, it was like you're like a movie star over there. I mean, it was like. And then you come back and you go to Carrollton.
Hey, did they, and you're a movie star there too, Jerry. Did they pay all your expenses when you were making those trips, Jerry?
They paid everything but your food. When you left this country, you had a round-trip ticket. And then when you got there, I mean, all the traveling, everything was covered except your food. And let me tell you something. They didn't put you – we didn't stay with Tom Baudet over there. I'm talking about they put us – we stayed in swanky hotels. I mean, nothing but swanky hotels. They treated us – you know, and then a lot of guys – I went over there one time. Bobby, I don't know. Mike, you may remember him. Jay, I don't know if he was ever in Jordan. You remember Terry Gibbs?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Manny Sam.
He told me one time, he said, if I ever get back home, I'll never come back over here ever again. I mean, it's after you're there. I went so many times, it bothered me. But after you're there about 3 weeks, I mean, it starts getting to you. You can't speak the language. You know, you can't. The food, you know, is what it is. But you learn how to do, you know.
Uh-huh.
He never went back. He said, I wouldn't go back at no price, ever. It wasn't for him. But I loved it.
Well, at least
know?
They didn't make you go on a game show or sing karaoke on TV, because I know they did a lot. That, especially Dick Beyer, he was on every game show they ever had over there.
Well, he basically lived over there, didn't he?
He had his own show.
He had his own show.
Oh, he was over, my gosh, was he? Oh, my gosh. I think he lived there 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
And he lost his wife to a Japanese fellow.
Hmm.
I don't know if you knew that.
No.
But anyhow, he had his own show. I mean, there's no telling what he made over there. I mean, he was over. But, yeah, it was great. And their TV stuff was just... I mean, when we pull up and see they was doing TV, you think they was doing Super Bowl. Nothing they did was cheap. I'm telling you, it was first class. Everything was first class. The traveling was first class. I mean, the buses, we traveled on a bus. It was like a gigantic Greyhound, you know, had all Japan Pro Wrestling on it. And it was just, I mean, it was immaculate. The travel, you know, we'd ride on the bullet train some, we'd fly some, be on ships sometimes. I mean, everything was first class. I mean, it was just
How long would a tour over there generally last, Jerry, when you would go over there?
Four to five weeks.
Now, would you book that directly, or did you have an intermediary that, because of the language problems and everything else, that that helped put that together for you?
After I started going, I would always set up when I could come back, you know, get a return date. Then I know one time Stan Hensley called me. He said, you're going to Japan? I said, I'm going such and such. I said, yeah. I said, yeah, book me. He got me a couple of times over there. Stan and I were real close.
Yeah, he stayed over there a long time too, didn't he?
Well, that's what he finally did there the last, I don't know how many years, that's all he did.
Yeah, he was a legend there too.
Yes, he went like, those guys went like 16 weeks a year. The ones that went all the time like that. Sometimes he'd come for a week and be gone.
Yeah, his last few tours over there, he said he didn't, you know, he could go over there and make enough money. He didn't have to work anywhere else. You know, that was...
Absolutely.
Yep.
Now, Jay, back to what you were asking, and correct me if I'm wrong, Jerry, but as far as once the guys were over there, didn't Joe Higuchi work a lot with helping you guys, you know, through the day-to-day stuff?
He traveled with us. Stan Hansen. I love Joe. I sat right across from him. And all we did was play cribbage on all those trips. He said, you know why Joe's on this bus, don't you? I said, yeah, I know why. He said, that's to keep the law. Did you ever hear about him beating Victor Rivera up on the bus?
No.
Oh, yeah. I wasn't there. Stan told me about it. He said Victor Rivera kept running his mouth about these Japs, these Japs, that. Stan said, you better shut up, man. And Joe was the nicest, greatest guy in the world. I mean, so he said Joe got up out of his seat and beat him all over that bus. Joe was tough.
I saw some pictures of the training regimen that those Japanese guys went through. It was unbelievable what they had to do to, you know, to become a main eventer.
Oh, it was. They put those guys through it, and you know, they would. They made the young boys. A lot of times, they'd be there when we get there to a town. They'd already be there, and they'd have the young boys, and they always. Oh my God, they wore the most gorgeous warm-up suits. They all dressed alike, you know. Everything was professional. Had all Japan Pro Wrestling on the back, and all and they'd be there at the bus, and when we got off the bus, they'd take it to the buildings. And then when we go to the ring, they would be all dressed in there after they already worked. The young boys, they'd work first, and then they would get through and they'd shower and they'd put, you know, their sweats back on, matching sweats, the tops and the pants. And then they would take us to the ring, you know, get the fans back. But it was just class.
Yeah, of course, I wasn't around long enough to ever do it, but I always wanted to go to Japan. I always wanted to go to Australia.
That was my one regret, not going to Australia.
Well, you had your chance, but you weren't hungry. You'd already eaten.
I know. But they worked that whole country, and it was like they would be like in New York tonight, and tomorrow night they'd be in Los Angeles. They'd go to Perth, Adelaide. I mean, they flew every day. They worked that whole country. And it's big like the United States, you know.
But yeah, and then they'd pick up, sometimes they'd go to New Zealand or jump over to Singapore.
Yeah. Yep. I didn't. Of course, actually, Barnett still had it when I got in the business, but then after that, I don't remember when he left there, but then it was never the same. I think
no.
Steve Rickard tried to run it.
Steve Rickard, yeah. Ron Miller, I think, had part of it.
But it was over the lane. But yeah, I regret that. And then I know when I was there, Ted and I were there. They wanted Ted and I and the butcher to go to Korea. I'm gonna make a long story short. Ted decided he didn't want to go. So I'm going, man, you know, we're already here. What's another week? They said, we'll pay you the same money. They'll pay you the same money. They'll fly you to Korea and back to Japan. And then, you know, you take your ticket on back home. So I said, I'll go. Because I've been out with my knee already for 9 weeks. And, you know, that extra week of money, what they pay, was, I wasn't going to miss that. So myself, Butcher, and a guy named Johnny Gray from Australia went. And that was an experience. I would never want to go back there. It wasn't anything like Japan. I mean, they treated us all right, but Japan, that place is immaculate. Korea was kind of dirty, and like I said, they paid for our food. So Johnny Gray said, we've been there about 3 days. He says, come downstairs to the hotel and get something. I said, okay. So we went down there to get something to eat. So he said, what do you do? I said, let's order a steak. Well, we ordered a steak. I took one bite. I still don't know what I bit into. I'm telling you, y'all laugh if you want to. I pushed it back. I said, God, man, I'm not eating this. I don't know what I ate. It was a water buffalo or a dog or what. So the last night.
Well, see,
night
you
there,
should have been used to that all the time you spent in Louisiana.
I watched what I ate there, too, brother. Don't think. So the last night there, they got Butcher and I in a tag match against Oki Kuntero and some other Korean. So it's about, I don't know, 25, 30 minutes outside Seoul, Korea. So this is in November, October, November. It's cold. In November, it's cold as rip. So they take us out. I think we're going to a building. They take us out to this open field. I don't know how many thousands of Koreans right there. They have no bleachers, no chairs, nothing. They sitting on the ground. Thousands. I'm talking about thousands, thousands of them. We're sitting on the bus. We're watching the matches. So I finally asked one of them guys, I said, hey, man, how cold is it? How cold is it out there? It was cold, but, your temperature, 28 degrees.
Oh, man.
I had to go out there in a pair of trunks and shorts and boots to wrestle for 28 in 28-degree weather with Butcher. Now, you can imagine what went on in that thing.
I bet that ring was hard as Chinese arithmetic.
You got no idea, brother. No shot. This will split my chest. So that was an experience. I mean, it was, when I was there another time, we got to go to Okinawa. And I always wanted to go to Hong Kong and Singapore, but, those wasn't running, but I know. So Joe Iguchi is going with me and Joe. I mean, with me and Butcher and Johnny Gray to Korea. So I'm sitting up next to Joe on the plane. I said, "Hey, Joe," I said, "you speak Korean?" He said, "No, me saying is you." He didn't speak Korean. So that was another world.
How was working with those guys? Did they work very stiff with you?
About like the Japanese boys. They were tough though. I'm telling you, those Japanese boys are tough, too. Talk about in shape. My gosh. They work a little different than us. They work. They want you moving, you know.
It's like working with Danny Hodge every night.
More or less. More
you're talking about
in
Korea.
Same,
that was through Baba? You went to Korea?
No, that was done through a Korean office. Oki Kuntero ran that.
Okay,
because
I know Inoki did a lot of stuff in Korea. But you're talking about,
yeah.
And probably the oddest thing, and I've seen bits and pieces of it, I think it's on YouTube, Inoki and Saito had a match on an island. It was just the two of them. There was no crowd, no nothing. They were on this island. I think Inoki owned the island or something. It was like
I don't
it's the craziest thing I've ever seen.
Did you tell Ted he made the right decision after you came back?
He regrets not going.
Does he?
Yeah, he regrets it. He regrets it. Yeah, you know, I figured, you know, I'm that close. What's another hour and a half
right.
the other way, you know?
Right. You didn't know it was going to be 28 degrees, though, right?
No, I did not. I'd have bought some home down there. No.
Outside.
But I tell you what I did do, though. I had two tailor-made leather coats, jackets, and two tailor-made shirts made for $125.
Oh, my goodness. When you showed up, did they pay you part of your money up front and then part of it when you were finished, or how did that work?
Paid us when we left.
Okay.
Cash, American money. American money. And in Japan, same way. I always took money with me, you know, not enough to make the whole tour. I was over there to bring money home, not leave it.
Right.
You know? And I would take probably between $500 and $600 with me. And you could get by, if you knew what you were doing, if you've been over there enough, you could get by on a couple of hundred a week eating, because they pay for everything else. And then not counting what you bought, like cameras or watches or anything like that, but just your food. You could get by on a couple of hundred. And sometimes offers take you out. Sometimes the guy in Tokyo, we call him Joe the Pearl Man. You go by and buy pearl. He'd take you out to eat a couple of times, and offers would take you out sometimes. And some other fans would take you out there. They want to be seen with you, you know. And I said, okay, you can be seen with me. You're paying for it. I'll go with you, you know. But then while you were there, you could get draws. They said Bobby Jaggers, when they got ready to pay him, they didn't owe him nothing. He done drawn all his money.
He owed them money. That's no joke.
So
he had to pay them money
night,
to get out of the country.
I think he had to borrow some to get out. But the last night you wrestled, they'd call you when it was your turn, and they'd shut those 100s out to you, brand new 100s to you. You never worried about your money. You could get a draw every night if you wanted it. After I go through my money, you know. If I was going to buy a lot of stuff, that's when I'd take a little extra, you know, because I didn't want to keep drawing money.
Right.
But you were drawing on your own money, so that was up to you what you wanted to do.
Yeah. What'd you buy while you were over there in the web? I know you bought a good camera.
I still got it, Bobby.
What'd you
buy? I bought Bobby Simmons. What did I buy? I had some boots made. I had Bobby Simmons some boots made.
Yeah, and brought me a pair of boots back.
With Bobby Simmons, I'm sure, paid me for them. But I still got watches that I bought. I still have those. The camera. I bought my wife some pearls that she still has. I used some kimonos. I bought some stuff in Okinawa, which I'm sitting here looking at it now. I didn't buy a whole lot of stuff. You know, I was into watches, you know.
Yeah.
But I still got my watches.
The last watch I bought over there, I had Stan Hansen buy me a watch. I gave him some money when he was leaving to go over there. And he was coming back. I knew he was coming back to Atlanta when he came back. I had him get me a watch. You could get a watch for $90 at the Seiko store. I never went there, but the Tokyo Hilton had a Seiko store in it, and for $90 you could get whatever the hottest Seiko watch was in the States at the time. $300-$500 here, and it was $90 over there.
Wow,
that's right. That camera I bought a Nikon, and Ted bought one too. We paid. This is in 76. I paid $250 for it, and it was $600 here. But those days are gone. The American dollar is no good anymore, you know. So it's the first time I went, the exchange rate was you give them a dollar, and they gave you 312 yen. And the last time I went, you give them a dollar, and they give you 120 yen. So it's a buck, you know, it's 100 yen for the buck. Yeah, so it's a dollar for a dollar now. I mean, you know.
Yeah.
But when you got triple, you can buy stuff right. I buy unbelievable Seiko watches, like Bobby's talking about. Sometimes I mean, every time I go back, they have a different one. You know, 55, 65, or 90 bucks. You would never pay over $90 for the watch.
Yeah.
Anything you wanted. And pearls were just, oh my gosh. And she still got a ring she wears, and people are like, my God, where'd you get that? And it's just gorgeous. But I was blessed to get to do what I did, and I could have never gone all these places that I went. Even in this country, you know, people save up for a lifetime just to go to the places that I got to go, and I'm thankful for that. I got a lot of memories, met a lot of great people, a lot of, you know, like tonight, get to do this, you know.
I think that's the thing I treasure more than anything was the people that I got to meet and get close to over the years.
We met all kinds. Great people, scumbags, you know, met them all.
You ain't lying.
I mean, really.
All at the same time. In the same dressing room sometimes.
In the same place. How many people can do that? Yep, it was a heck of a run for all of us. And you know, to sit here and talk about what we knew, and of course nothing stays the same, I know that, but I mean, to taking something that was so dear and so precious to so many of us, and you know, I always had it in my mind, even at my age today, I thought I'd still be connected with the business somehow, some way, you know, running a town or something. You'd be connected with it somehow because of the love you had for it, but that was all taken away from all of us.
There's just no business anymore.
No, no, you're right, Jay. I mean, you could still be doing announcing or commentating, or you could still be doing something, you know, even today. But all that was taken. See, I look at it in that aspect. It was taken away from all of us.
Right.
And that's why I don't watch it. You know, and I just... And I just don't respect what he did to it. That's you know, that's, of course, that's just how I feel. And, of course, you know, who would ever dream some of the boys would make the money that they've made? And I don't begrudge that. I don't begrudge that. Not $1 I begrudge. We were just ahead of our time. That's all I can tell you. And that's all I got to say to them.
Well, I tell you what, Jerry, it's been an education for me just to hear you talk from week to week about your experiences and, you know, how down to earth, because, you know, there's guys that even today would still feel the need to build themselves up and make it into something that wasn't. But, you know, I think that's just the kind of guy you are, and you've told the good with the bad, but it's been very, very interesting to hear your comments.
Well, I try to be truthful about everything I say. You know, I'm not going to embellish anything I didn't do or did do. It was, you know, I was blessed and just, you know, I just hate to see what happens to a lot of guys. You know, some of it's their fault, some of it wasn't their fault, but. We got a wonderful thing. I had somebody asking me this week that do I miss doing that? I said I think about it every day.
Absolutely.
Yep.
That may sound sick, and I tell them it wasn't an ego thing that I was on TV or. I said it's something that you can't explain if you never did it. I said you walk out of a dressing room. All these people are there, and you get in the ring, and they announce you, and you know you're going to do something that you love to do. I said it was fun. It was a job, and you had to work hard. I said, but I think that it's so much. It wasn't a job. You know, what you were doing. It was to me. It was a high that you couldn't buy. You couldn't smoke
exactly.
It or sniff it and get it. It was to me. That was my high every night.
Yep.
You know, I was only in the business less than 3 years, nothing like you and Bobby or Jay. And I go to bed every night thinking of some how I'd work this match or what that match. And, you know, I can imagine what it's like for you guys. It's been, you know, 15, 20 years doing it.
I think Harley summed it up when he said one time, he said, once you're under that spotlight, Daddy, he says, you always want to get back.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I feel the same way about the radio business and even the music business. I mean, there's many nights that you know, I dream that I'm working in a studio. You know, it just it's, that's just so ingrained in you, you just can't help it.
But you love doing it. You love doing it. That was the whole thing, you know.
Well, guys, we are out of time, so good show tonight. I think this was fun and insightful, and for those who are listening in, I hope they found it the same way, and I have no clue what we're going to do next week, but we'll do something, so I thank you guys for, as always,
well, let's
for
do what we did tonight.
Show with us.
Have at it.
That's
right.
Usually the way, when we don't plan anything, it's usually turn out to be the best show.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it very much.
Well, thank you, guys.
I enjoyed you,
guys. We'll get together next week, and we'll do it again.
All
thank
right.
you so much.
Good night,
good night
guys.
Everybody.
We thank you for listening to this broadcast, a production brought to you by the GWH Radio Network. Stay tuned to GeorgiaWrestlingHistory.com for the latest information on upcoming events and more. As always, we thank you for your continued support.